Accession number 4784, reel 7.
Reverend Sam Bash, reel 6.
Yes, I have just been mentioning Sir Bendler Grayburn, who was the chief manager of the Hong Kong and Shanghai Bank, a man with tremendous power and authority in Hong Kong, equal to the governor, perhaps in some ways more so. Well, he and his next in command, a man named Edmondson, they were kept out in the early days, sort of handling the affairs of the bank, and in some way, I don't know the ins and outs of this, only bankers would know that, in some way sort of making some sort of arrangements for the Japanese to take over the functions of the Hong Kong Shanghai Bank. And he and the bank staff were kept out for quite a long, long time, until the Japanese discovered that in some way that I don't understand or know about, he was getting money into the camp and also getting money into various agencies in Hong Kong who were helping us in the camp. And he was arrested, and several other of the bank staff were arrested and put into the Hong Kong prison itself, which was adjacent, of course, to our camp. As a matter of fact, my own little room looked right into the prison and into the exercise ground, and I myself saw Sir Vandler and Mr. Edmondson and a man named Hyde being brought out every day for exercise. We had no communication with them, nor they with us. Lady Grayburn and Mrs. Edmondson, who'd been out with their husbands, and Mrs. Hyde, they were all brought into the camp at that time when their husbands were arrested, and they never had any contact with their husbands in the camp. I myself could see that poor Grayburn particularly was going steadily downhill, because from the time when he could walk about in a sprightly way, I used to see him totter out and then sit down, and then eventually the news came through that he died. And our doctors were allowed to go in then and examine, and they discovered that he had literally been starved to death. He had died of starvation. Some little time after that, Mrs. Edmondson was called to go into the camp. The only time she had been in, it was just to say goodbye to her husband, because he also died, and from the same cause. And Hyde was executed.
On the subject of money, did you ever get any relief payments while you were in?
No. No, we were dependent upon what we happened to have with us when we went in, and as to what sort of monies we could raise for various purposes, either through the sale of our valuables or through our checks. That's how we financed ourselves through the camp.
Was there any system of barter as well as of?
Oh, yes, yes.
How did that work?
We used to have public sessions of auctions and barter. Some of the most valuable things in an internment camp or prison camp are such things as tin cans. Anybody happens to have a spare spoon. In fact, you can go through, I think I can say that I pretty well went through the 3 years of the Hong Kong of the internment camp with a tin can, a spoon, and an enamel plate.
One of the subjects that interests me is morale. You said in our earlier talk that a lot of the internees became a bit bloody-minded and angry and felt they'd been let down by the government. In
the early days, that is so.
Yes.
And as I said at the time, the beginning of that was the government reports about a Chinese army coming to our rescue, and this buoyed people up and felt that it was going to be all right. And of course, there was nothing in it at all. It was untruth, it was falsehood.
What forms did that anti-government feeling take? How was it expressed?
Well, when we came up for the first elections, for example, anybody with anything to do with government stood no chance at all of being elected. This changed later on, and people did realise that they'd nothing to do with it anyhow, and they were decent, competent people, and they found their way onto the governing committees as time went on. But in the early days, a bit unreasonably in a way, but this is what happens when people are upset and disturbed, the anti-government feeling started, and there were those who fanned the flames, and it took a fair bit to die down.
Was there any... what kind of things got you down? What kind of things depressed morale?
It's difficult for me to talk about how other people may have felt. Of course, I'm a convinced Christian. It was my Christian faith that kept me going. It was there that I discovered the reality of what I've ever since talked about as invisible spiritual resources. And I can honestly say I came through that camp buoyant, optimistic, glad I had a job to do. In fact, I'm sure, as a minister, I did the best work of my life in that camp, in sort of helping the camp, working in the camp, helping to bring comfort and good cheer to other people. And when it was all over, I was greatly, greatly moved at the number of people who took the trouble to write to me and say a word of thanks for that sort of thing. Mm. That's what kept me going. Now, there were other people who had no beliefs of this nature, and it has to be said that in the absence of something like this, something that was your foundational belief, you were in trouble. And you went to pieces, and people did go to pieces, because they felt that there was no hope, no future. We had one particular instance of this. Mm. Now, in a camp like that, of course, you get your characters. We had two notorious ones with us. We had the famous One-Arm Sutton. We also had the Two-Gun Cohen. Have you heard of either of them? You're too young. Both of them sold us a fortune. Both wrote books about themselves, and they had books written about them, which were very popular, say, what, 20, 30 years ago. One-Arm Sutton, Frank Sutton, great, big, strong, strapping man, 6 foot six, powerful in proportion to it, Oxford, Eton, Oxford, went out to Gallipoli. That's where he lost his arm, but so adjusted to it that he could do as much with one arm as most people could with two. He became a soldier of fortune in China, linked up with the warlords, that sort of thing, came to Hong Kong and established a business supplying munitions to the warlords in China. He was caught up with us and, of course, came into camp. Well, Frank was going to survive, and he did his daily dozen every day. Until the end of the third year, I came to know him very well. He used to call me the Book. One day somebody said to me, "You'd better go and have a look at Frank, he's in the hospital." So I went, and there he was in the hospital. I said, what are you doing here, Frank? He said, "Ernest, I've had enough." He said, "There's no future here." He said, "What's going to happen is we're going to rot away. And that'll be the end of us." He said, "I'm not waiting." I said, "Don't talk to me like that, Frank. This is not Frank Sutton." Made no impression on him. Believe me, this happened. I went down to see him one day, trying to rouse him. He died with me trying to do that at his bedside, for the simple reason he'd lost the will to live.
And was Cohen a similar example?
Now, Cohen, Two-Gun Cohen, he came into the camp with a great reputation. At one time, he was personal bodyguard to Chiang Kai-shek. And it was his boast that he could throw a coin in there and shoot a hole through it with either hand before he got to the ground. I don't know if he could or not. Anyway, he maintained a low profile in the camp because he was afraid of the Japanese getting to know too much about him. But in some mysterious way, I don't know to this day how he did it, but he was that sort of operator, he got himself repatriated with the Canadians, and he was a Jew and a Liverpudlian.
Were there any other cases of that sort of depression that you described?
Oh, yes. Oh, yes. Yes. There were people who, you know, would go to various points in the camp and spend hours staring out to sea, not talking to anybody. Of course, partly malnutrition, partly a physical condition. But unless you'd something to hold on to keep you going, well, that's what happened to quite a lot of people. As I say, inertia, lack of concentration, just don't care.
Was there any noticeable difference between...
Now, we had no suicides, I'm glad to say, and we had no murders, and that was a wonderful thing too, with a conglomeration of people together like that. We had our fisticuff affairs and all that sort of thing from time to time, but nothing, fortunately, that ended in that drastic way.
Were you able to detect any difference between the ability of the men and as compared with the ability of the women to cope with
I would give the women full marks. I think, of the two, mind you, I don't say much about the men. I mean, nothing wrong. There were differences among them. Some were wonderful, some weren't. But by and large, I think the women stand this better than men.
Did you find in the conditions at Stanley that... many people turn to religion as a prop?
I've remarked, I think, before, that the church did a wonderful job. We had our regular services. We worked together as a body of Christians without any denominational tags, apart from either being Protestants or Roman Catholics. And at that time, nobody would have expected, especially among the clergy, any closer coming together than that on the part of the Roman Catholics and the non-Romans. We had some wonderful Catholic priests in the camp, and we cooperated with them in all sorts of ways, in other connections, but they had their special services, and we had ours. But we had ours as a band of Christians, and we called ourselves the Stanley United Congregations. And we all attended the same services. They were conducted by those of us in turn, whose turn it happened to be to conduct the service, whether we were Methodist, Anglican, Presbyterian, or what have you. And there's no doubt that those services attracted people, and in those conditions provided something that they felt they wanted. And our services were crowded, absolutely crowded. The only thing that interfered with that later on was that the St. Stephen's Great Hall was a fair distance from some other parts of the camp, and some folk became too weak that they could hardly walk the distance from one to the other, especially as it involved going up and down the only hill that was in the camp. But together with that, the church also organised discussion groups, study classes, all that sort of thing, certainly people would speak in the highest terms of all that the church meant to them in the camp. Mm. And particularly this united condition. And many people used to say to me, now, this is right. We believe in this. We hope that this is what will happen after the war. Mm. I hoped it would too. And that's why I've gone up and down this country. And I have. Talking about the necessity for unity.
Can you recall any particular cases, perhaps amongst surprising people, who turned to religion as a prop during the...
Oh, yes. We had people who'd never gone to church for years. I think the main reason for going in Stanley was that it was somewhere to go to, for one thing, and where people enjoyed singing hymns. As part of the service, and then attending the service and absorbing something of what the service was designed to do, both in its hymns, in its prayers, in its reading of the scriptures, in the sermons that we preached, there were those on whom it made its profound impression. And there are people in Christian service today who first found their way back to the religion of their childhood in the camp. No doubt about that.
Did any contrary cases occur, that is, of people losing their religion? One could envisage that.
I suppose there would be. I can't think of any that came to my attention. And I mean, I suppose I was I knew as much about that camp as any other person in it, because I was in every part of it, you see, because of my being deputy chairman to the colonial secretary. I was well known to everybody. Everybody knew me. People talked to me freely. But there would be those who I expect would feel, well, it's no good to me.
Mm. We've talked,
but they never found anything else.
We've talked exclusively so far about, almost exclusively, about life in the camp. I'm interested in knowing what sort of contacts you had with the world outside of the camp. I mean, for example, with home, with your family and friends.
Well, that is one of the indictments that we have against the Japanese authorities. Our connection with home, or their connection with us, was nil from beginning to end. I think the limit that anybody ever got into the camp in the way of communication from home was about three letters in the whole of the 3 years. They were so out of date that whatever they said didn't mean anything, because the situation could have changed. We were allowed to write at intervals, not more than about three communications, which were supposed to go to our families. Most of them never got there. The shocking thing was that the husbands and fathers of a lot of the women and children in our camp were in their camp at Sham Shui Po, which was only just across the harbour. And there was no contact between those two camps and those people, and it would have been so easy all the way through. And those men didn't know what was happening to their wives and children, and the wives didn't know what was happening to them. There came a time in the history of the camp at Sham Shui Po when a lot of the prisoners there were taken off to be working parties in Japan. They were taken up in a ship called the Osama Maru, and this was attacked by American submarines, who didn't know, of course, the cargo that it was carrying, and a lot of those men were lost on the way to Japan. And those women, many of them, never knew anything about this until the war was over.
Did you have any contact with relief organizations like the Red Cross?
Through Mr. Zindel, that's all. Nothing else.
Was that an official link?
I don't know that anything came of it. People at home only got to know something about us through one or two of the early escapes from the camp, and then one or two folk from Hong Kong itself getting into Free China with certain information which they had gathered, and that's how some of our folk at home came to know that some of us were still alive.
Did Mr. Zindel have access to the camp, if he wanted to, through the Japanese?
He had access through the Japanese, but they limited it very much indeed. We saw not too much of him throughout the whole of the 3.5 years, but that was not his fault. It was just that they didn't want to have anything to do with this sort of thing. And they had no interest in our interests. They'd very little interest in keeping us alive.
On those few occasions when Mr. Zindel did get access to the camp, what kind of services or functions did he carry out?
Well, he would do an inspection of the camp, an inspection of kitchens and that sort of thing, find out just what scale of rations were coming in at that particular time. But as a rule, he was so surrounded with Japanese authorities that it was almost impossible for any of us to get in touch with him or say anything to him. A friend of mine, a Major Barnett, a remarkable man, a courageous man too, on one occasion when he came in, he shouted to Mr. Zindel as he was going past, "Mr. Zindel, we're starving to death here. Can't you do something about it?" And a Hong Kong guard hit him on the ear with a broom, with a bamboo pole rather, And poor old Ken Barnett has been deaf ever since.
What was a major doing in a civilian internment camp?
That was his rank in the original Hong Kong Volunteers, but when he was caught up, he came to be with us.
Oh, I see. He was a part-time soldier.
Yes, yes, yes.
Radio, you've mentioned before in connection with the executions, but how many radios did you have in Stanley, and how did you get them?
I believe, and I think I'm right in this, that we had three radios altogether, the existence of two of which was known only to those who had them and myself as the chairman. The other one, which caused all the trouble, the existence of that became known to too many, I fear. And I think I've said before, there's always a Judas in every camp who, for reasons that we can never understand, will betray the rest of us, and we were betrayed to the Japanese, and I'm sure they knew all about this radio before they actually pounced, and they found out who was operating it, who had any connection with it, ultimately where it was buried when people got alarmed and decided that that's how they would deal with it. How they came to be there, that one I think was built by the radio technicians we had in the camp, who had parts smuggled in to make it through the ration truck. I think the other two were probably already in the camp in the warder's quarters, and were in the camp when we got there, and somebody found them and laid hold of them and said nothing about it. But because of that, we kept pretty well au fait with all that was happening outside.
Where were they used?
You tell me.
I thought you said you knew.
Well, I knew of their existence. Mm. I didn't want to know. Mm. I mean, I was in danger then. In fact, how I escaped being taken out with the party who were executed, I can only explain by saying that in ways unknown to me, the good Lord must have had more work for me to do in this world. Because I was arrested, first of all, and then let come out. Mm. The two that operated secretly, well, whoever had them, they had their own hiding place, and it was secure all the way through the camp. As I say, the other, too much was known, and that was the result. Seven men executed.
The sort of news you were getting through these secret wirelesses, how was it distributed?
Word of mouth. People talked. And when the end actually came, we knew that the Japanese had surrendered. A day before, they announced it to us, but we didn't say anything.
It must have been difficult to hide. They must have been puzzling why you were also looking so much happier that day. Newspapers, did you have access to newspapers at all?
That again is interesting. There came a time when the Japanese published an English version of their paper, and it had some astounding stories in it, particularly their reports about how the war was going from their point of view, and the astonishing number of warcraft and planes that they were destroying in the various engagements that they reported. But we set aside two or three very experienced journalists. We had one of these papers in every day for quite a long period. And we asked these experienced men to make a study of the paper, you know, to forget all that nonsense, and to try to read between the lines and let us know what they thought was really happening. And they did a very good job, a very clever job. The result was that their reports to us and their forecasts were very near the truth of what actually happened when it did come to happen. And that newspaper, whilst amusing us in many ways, worrying some people who in those circumstances begin to say, well, you know, there might be something in it. But when they talked about having sunk more ships that had never been built, well, people began to realise that it was just a propaganda exercise.
Can you remember any notable discrepancies between the broadcast you were getting from the BBC, presumably, on the one hand, and what you were reading in the Japanese newspapers?
Mainly in what I've just mentioned, namely the numbers. I mean, they were announced so many battleships, so many aircraft carriers, so many larger craft, so many cruisers, so many destroyers. Then all these had been sunk. And then so many more believed sunk and that sort of thing. When he came to total the thing up, it was just fantastic. Just absolutely fantastic. Mm-hmm. And we had one of these men I've talked about who was set aside to look at the papers. He used to issue a bulletin every day about what he'd found in the paper. And first of all, he would make a reference to these figures that had been published and say, so many battleships sunk immediately, so many others in rather more leisurely fashion. but then give us the real bits of good news that he thought he could see. And he was right.
Was there any other newspapers available than the Japanese-produced ones?
The only others were papers that sometimes the careless sentries left in their sentry boxes. And we had people, of course, who could read both Chinese and Japanese. And that gave us quite a lot of information that did not come in the paper that they issued to us.
What sort of contact did you have with the civilian population of Hong Kong?
What, during the camp years?
Yes.
None at all. None at all. The only contact we had, perhaps I'll qualify, none at all, it was their contact with us that really counted. The amazing thing is that in spite of the bad time that some of them were having, there were those among them who evidently had sufficient resources for this, and they began to send parcels into the camp to some of their friends in the camp. This was one of the most generous things I've ever known of anywhere. This did happen, and in some way, and they ran risks in doing it, they got parcels into the camp. And one or two people were receiving them fairly regularly, and good luck to them. I myself received 3 parcels, I think it was, in the whole of the camp history. And one of those came from, those 3 rather, came from a Swiss friend of mine who was a member and official of the same Masonic lodge that I was a member of and ultimately master of in Hong Kong. And he managed to get hold of our lodge funds in Hong Kong. And he used that money to send parcels to the members of the lodge that he knew were in Hong Kong. A man named Snaith, dear man. Well, there were other people in this category, and these parcels used to come in like that. Mm. But that we'd no contact with them. They couldn't say anything to us. They couldn't say anything to them. And we had to wait until the end of the war, until we could express our thanks and appreciation to them. But that was the link. We knew that they were there because of what they were sending.
So the only outside contact you had was with the local Red Cross?
That's right, yes. Mm-hmm. Can I say a word about the children, other than the provision we made for them physically? Because we established schools for the children, and we had a wonderful, devoted band of teachers, just as we had just a grand set of doctors and nurses. And the senior school met in the Assembly Hall of St. Stephen's, and the junior school in the Recreation Hall of the Prison Officers Club. They divided the year into the usual terms, and the children had their terms at school, they had their holidays. There was, in the early days, until we began to get more requisites in, practically nothing in the way of school equipment or school requisites. But as I say, they gradually built these things up. And those teachers did a wonderful job with those children. And those children came to have a great affection for their teachers. And when it was all over, and they got back to England, Australia, Canada, or wherever they belonged, it was discovered that our children were ahead and not behind their contemporaries who'd been living in freedom. Our teachers did such a wonderful job, and I do want to pay tribute to them for what they did.
Yes.
And in our own ways, we saw to it that they got their little extras at the times of the year when that was done. At Easter, we got Easter eggs into the camp. Christmas time, we saw that they had remembrances from Father Christmas. We did look after our children.
I imagine that one of the problems in Stanley, for a lot of people anyway, was just the problem of filling time. In that context, what kind of activities were developed on well, let's go through them, on the, say, sporting and recreation side?
In the earlier days, we did play games, beginning with football and then with softball. But because of what I've said about brittle bones and so on, that had to be stopped. And then all other activities were the quieter things, as I've said, like bridge parties, bridge tournaments, talks, lectures, concerts, language classes, all that sort of thing. A tremendous lot of that activity built up and went on. Together with that, we managed to get in at one point the books from the American Club Library. When we first went into the camp, books were prohibited. We weren't allowed to take anything like that in, even if we'd been able to do so. And then these books came as a gift from the gods, absolutely, because there was a good selection, they were good stuff. And we had a magnificent librarian, although a loan to herself, absolutely. She was the wife of the head of one of the firms of solicitors in Hong Kong, Mrs. Brooke. Oh, dear, oh, dear, she ruled that library with a rubber band, but she looked after it, and and these books were kept in good circulation, and this filled in a lot of the time that you're speaking about. And also provided ammunition for speakers, lecturers, who were willing to give talks, lectures, from time to time in the camp.